and welcome to the Belt and Road podcast. We cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm one of your hosts, Eric Mike Serino, coming to you today from a beautiful Samora, North Carolina. And as always, I'm joined by the wonderful Julia Liu up in Ithaca. Juliet, how's it going?
Hi, Eric. It's going well.
Before we begin, I just want to remind everyone, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, analysis, and of course, join the discussion on all things Belt and Road, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Belt and Road Pod.
Definitely encourage you to follow us. We have a ton of news coming out on both of those platforms. Speaking of news, reading media headlines about China and climate issues these days is confusing. China is sometimes talked about as a major emitter of greenhouse gases, which it is. It overtook the US a couple years ago. At the same time, it's historic, and per capita emissions have not yet overtaken the US or a lot of other industrialized countries. China is a hub for renewable energy technology production, but it's also one of the biggest sources and consumers of things like coal, which also emit huge amounts of greenhouse gases. But what about China on the front of global climate change governance? On this front, there are huge changes afoot, and China's importance in global climate change governance is growing, and it is taking on much more of a leadership role, especially in terms of engaging the global South. So here today to talk to us about this topic is Jeffrey Qi. Jeffrey is a policy analyst with the International Institute for Sustainable Development's Resilience Program, and I just should just note that he is here expressing his own views on our podcast, not necessarily as a representative of SD. Jeffrey is based in Vancouver. He works on supporting developing countries' national adaptation planning processes and the implementation of the Paris Agreement and the UN Convention on Biological Diversity. The research we're going to focus on for our discussion today was conducted with his supervisor, Professor Peter Dauvergne, when Jeffrey was a master's student in political science at the University of British Columbia. Hi, Jeffrey. Welcome to the Belt and Road podcast.
Hi, happy to be here.
Thank you so much for coming onto the show. First of all, I just want to get a little bit of context to the piece that you just wrote. What are some of the key highlights to consider in understanding China's existing record on global climate governance?
I think that's a great question. I think the context of China being a big emitter, but also now a purported leader in global climate action, also reflects a broader paradoxical image of China in the 21st century. It's a communist socialist country that is home to roughly 25% of the world's richest billionaires. It's a self-proclaimed non-interventionist, but its recent diplomatic ventures are all about shaping the world to its visions. But on climate action, I think China has been pretty consistent with its approach. And I believe there are three things to highlight here. First, China's stance on climate change mitigation, or reducing the amount of greenhouse gas emissions. So its stance on mitigation has always been that it is a global north responsibility. Here we are talking about historical emissions, that the fact that developed countries today started emitting during the Industrial Revolution, while developing countries started their own industrialization process much later than the majority of the OECD countries. So on climate mitigation, China's stance has always been consistent that there is a common responsibility for all countries to address climate change, but there are differentiated responsibilities for the global north to do more and provide more financing and supporting developing countries to do climate action. And second, China's climate policy position have largely been based on what Chinese decision maker may call the development trajectory of the country. We have to be clear here that the current level of technology and financial and human resources available to developing countries, emissions are inevitable in their efforts to reduce extreme poverty and to develop their economy. So for around 2.5 decades since the Rio Convention came into force, China has argued that poverty reduction and economic development was its main priority. Since President Xi and Premier Li's tenure, we see more emphasis on environmental protection and green development. This, I think, is largely based on Beijing's view that China has reached that development stage where extreme poverty have largely been resolved and there is a strong middle class across the country, where healthy environments are brought to the forefront of people's daily conversations. As environmental issues like the smog that's across the country have now become a question of political legitimacy for the Communist Party and its people's well-being, China's domestic green energy industry is also booming, so it's logical for China to strengthen its climate action that could simultaneously booster a new domestic industry, ensure social stability and political legitimacy, while being able to portray an image of responsible great power at the world stage. In contrast to the US's inaction and rising climate denial nationalism in many Western democracies. while we could applaud China's recent announcements of the 2030 and 2060 targets, we also have to note that it is highly insufficient compared to what the IPCC would recommend countries to do. And its core positions on climate negotiations have not really changed. It's a hardliner position on things like climate finance, carbon markets, and its opposition to a stronger and more rigorous transparency reporting standard. So China has its legitimate reasons for these hardliner positions, but the majority of the civil society observer will call these positions undermining the integrity of the Paris Agreement. But ultimately, it's a party-driven process for the Paris Agreement, and China's view on these stem from its core interests that we can't judge it too harshly here. But yeah, we should applaud China's new quote-unquote leadership position in the climate world, but we should also keep a skeptical eye on its actual implementation.
I haven't heard such a good summary of China's position in global climate governance efforts. That was awesome. Your article is really great in walking the line that you've laid out already in your answer to this first question. You guys are focusing on what China is doing versus what should be done and needs to be done, and giving what I think is a really balanced kind of practical approach to that. And I also like how forward-looking you guys are in that your article is not about China's record in the past necessarily, although you address it, but you're thinking about, okay, what about its growing involvement and influence in climate negotiations happening now and in the future. So can you give us a little sense of like how you did this research? How do you measure something as nebulous as influence? You talk about measuring China's discursive and diplomatic power in climate politics. What did you do actually for your master's research, and then how does that get measured?
Yeah, for sure. Messes question is always the hard question on any thesis defense, but yeah. I will try to provide the best answer here. So measuring kind of diplomatic power or measuring discursive power is always a challenging endeavor in political science research. Professor DeVerne and I took a two-pronged approach to our methodology in terms of this article. We first did a comprehensive literature review of both English language and Chinese language scholarship on China and global climate governance. We also reviewed major Chinese policy documents, government reports, think tank that are affiliated with the government, their reports and recommendations, etc., to better understand the rhetoric within China's policymaker and practitioner community. Then, of course, we relied on our collective experience and knowledge in climate diplomacy. In particular, I've been an observer to the Paris Agreement process for the last 5 years. So a lot of observations and hallway conversations were made during these conferences and negotiations that really better informed our research. So as I mentioned, measuring discursive power and diplomatic power, especially China's discursive power in a quantitative way, is a very challenging endeavor. And negotiations are pretty much confidential. It's really hard for a researcher to measure someone's growing power in climate diplomacy. There are very limited data and research out there. But then again, there are previous studies that would say what make a state powerful in climate negotiations. Scholars like McKibben, Jen Allen, and DeVerne, Mohim, they all had the previous studies on how moral leadership and the country's emission levels or their technological power could confer bargaining powers in climate negotiations. But to measure their growth over time is a very hard thing to do. How do you exactly measure a country's moral leadership in the climate world? So our main proposition were that, one, China is getting richer. It's getting more powerful in international affairs. This is a fact that's being established out there. It's very obvious that China is being more assertive in its diplomatic style that has been shifting away from the traditional hide your talent and bide your time doctrine proposed before. And it's getting more active in the climate world as well. People often go back to the Copenhagen COP in 2009, saying that China is a destructive player. It's a spoiler in the process, ultimately led to the failure of the Copenhagen Accord. But in recent years, we've seen negotiations that China is utilizing its soft power to get what it wants and shape the climate multilateral world. In climate negotiations, knowing how to block something is elementary. That's what China did back in Copenhagen. But the true sign of a country being more powerful in climate negotiations is to know how to use its veto player status and to know when to compromise and when to stick to its positions. So to us, this transformation from being a spoiler to a constructive player is a proxy for China's growing experience and power in the climate world. Secondly, we also look at China government's reports, position documents, and other affiliated organizations' reports, and see a growing call for China to engage more with developing countries, to engage more with these multilateral institutions, and to be a spokesperson of developing countries, being more assertive in defending its interests and contributing to the common goal of protecting the environment or a stronger climate action.
And sorry, just to clarify, when you say that there were calls, these are calls of like Chinese institutions, Chinese researchers calling the Chinese state to take on that role more. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So it's a conversation happening among Chinese leaders and thinkers to push the country in that direction. That's a really interesting way to look at that question of discursive shift.
Absolutely. The main motivation for us to look at these Chinese scholarship and also to look at government reports, policy documents, practitioner recommendations is to understand the rhetoric that's happening within the Chinese practitioner community, to understand what Chinese practitioners, what Chinese negotiators and policymakers are thinking and what their potential next move is in terms of the climate negotiations and multilateral climate process.
Yeah, it's really interesting. One portion within your methodology was looking at the, of course, the entire literature, but the English language and the Chinese language scholarship. I think lots of other papers I've read in this, there'll be language barriers and oftentimes only be utilizing the English language scholarship on China's climate diplomacy. Is there a big difference in what you found between English language and Chinese language scholarship in this field?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a pretty big difference between the two scholarships. What we found is that Chinese literature on global climate governance is a lot more normative, meaning that they read more like policy recommendations on what China should do in climate governance. There are more literature calling for Chinese knowledge or global south perspective in IPCC assessments to influence how IPCC views and assesses climate impacts and what are the policy recommendations stemming from those assessments. And there are also calls to create a more balanced, equitable, and cooperative climate governance system by adhering to the common but differentiated responsibilities principle. And also, interestingly, there are literature calling upon China to align with other developing countries to protect national interests and to demonstrate China is a responsible great power. And I remember there is one article particularly interesting about how global North countries would use climate finance to achieve their strategic ends in either negotiations or other diplomatic interests. And the article asserts that although China's aid on climate change is without strings attached, of course, and that the country should think about how to create a global South unity again to advance its own interest in climate diplomacy in the name of good for the entire developing countries bloc. But yeah, I think there's a big difference between the two scholarship. And again, the motivation to do this is to understand what Chinese practitioners are talking about, what are the mainstream rhetoric within the Chinese scholarship community on global climate governance. It definitely paid off to have a wealth of information coming from Chinese practitioner community.
That's super interesting. So I've heard this a lot. China talks about itself as one China lens to global South countries. It's South-South. China's positioning itself as a developing country, as a global South country. Can you give us a sense of why is North-South divide important to climate negotiations? And then I'll ask you about the common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities principle. Do you have a shorthand for that?
Make it easier. Yes, CBDRC.
Okay, great. So why does North-South matter to climate negotiations? And then why is that CBD, et cetera, principle important to China?
I think you're asking the million-dollar question for everyone working in climate negotiations on North-South divides. My answer to this is it's absolutely essential for China to position itself with global South and in some way to leverage that North-South divide to advance its own interest. And this is going to be a very long answer, so we should all strap in.
Should have cut it into two questions, but however the story plays out.
It will just be my monologue for the next few minutes. So the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities, it's a mouthful, it's CBDRRC. It's a cornerstone of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. It's in the actual convention, it's in the Kyoto Protocol, and it's now in the Paris Agreement. So what it basically is that recognizing the historical emissions by developed countries over hundreds of years of industrialization, that there is a differentiated responsibility between the global North and the global South. I think we often hear in global environmental politics that climate change is a wicked problem. It's called a wicked problem because it has an escalating scale. It's an escalating issue. It's becoming more impactful around the world. It has high uncertainty around its impacts and when those impacts will fall onto people. There is a great complexity over its causes and what continues to drive the climate crisis. The cause of climate change is not equal. For instance, in 2017, 82% of global wealth creation went to the top 1% of society. That wealthiest 10% of the world's population created half of the world's global greenhouse gas emissions. So when we look at history, it's very much the same thing. Developed countries have been using fossil fuel long before developing countries, and they have emitted way more than their global South counterparts since the start of the Industrial Revolution. In the 19th century and early 20th century, these Western nations were able to develop their domestic economy, increase industrialization and industrial agriculture, develop new technology, and found new scientific discoveries with their massive consumption of fossil fuel. Meanwhile, the big emitters today, India, China, Brazil, were very impoverished during the same time, all the way until after the World War. They never enjoyed the magic of industrialization because of their turbulent history, and now they're playing catch up with their developed counterparts.
I love this, the magic of industrialization. It's a great image.
And the priority for the Global South right now, or for the past 5 decades, has been to lift people out of poverty, to play that catch up. And the responsibility of the North is to provide the necessary financing and the resource support to developing countries so that they could adapt to climate change impacts and, to the level possible, reduce their emissions. All the while, the Global North countries have the historical responsibility to increase their mitigation ambition or take a bigger burden of reducing emissions from their domestic activities. So CBDRRC, this principle, is fundamentally about compelling the Global North to carry a more equitable burden of solving climate change for their historical emissions, for how much richer they are today, and for how technologically advanced they are today. And knowing the challenges and the hurdles Global South face in terms of their own economic and social development, recognizing every country, everyone, should pay their own fair share within the climate world. North-South divide in the climate space is fundamentally about equity and responsibility sharing. Global North wants developing countries to do more on mitigation, and the Global South argues developed countries need to pay for the bill and offer new technologies, offer new support on loss and damage that already occurred in many developing countries. Now we have the history and the context, we have a better understanding of why China might want to position itself with the Global South. Some might argue that China is one of the wealthiest and most technologically capable country in the world, and certainly doesn't look like a developing country. But our literature review and also our review of Chinese government positions have been clear is that Chinese government has been very consistent in asserting that China is a developing country with poverty and developmental issues, and it should continue to be classified as such within the climate world. China does this for a few reasons. First, it has always been a champion of the CBDRRC principle. What it translates to in practice is that developed countries and developing countries would operate under different legal obligations under the convention or under the Paris Agreement. So for example, under the Kyoto Protocol, developing countries enjoy flexibility over their climate action. That developed countries have the legal obligation to report on emissions and to reduce their own emissions. And over time, we see more developing countries, especially small island developing states, fearing for their own existential survival, are calling on China, Brazil, India to reduce emissions and to provide climate financing due to their high levels of emissions and increasing wealth. So the Paris Agreement in 2015 largely moved away from that annexed dichotomy, where both Global North and South countries have to submit their nationally determined contributions and increase their climate ambition every 5 years. But recognizing CBDRRC, of course. Developing countries enjoy certain flexibility under the agreement. For example, in terms of reporting, they don't have to report as extensively as developed countries. China doesn't really want to be on the hook to have that legal obligation to provide climate financing. It also doesn't want to be on the hook for the same level of scrutiny on its emission reduction plan like developed countries face, and enjoy the flexibility and the non-binding benefits that CBDRRC would offer to developing countries. And secondly, UNCCC, the Framework Convention, operates on a consensus decision-making model. So China no longer wants to be the ugly veto player in the climate world. It doesn't suit the image it wants to portray as a responsible great power.
So what I'm hearing basically is that China sits on this divide. The North and South question is about who foots the bill for the change that has to happen. And China is trying to basically be like, currently China is the biggest emitter, but historically it was not. And so it's trying to position itself basically so that it's falling into the category of countries that are not seen as contributing as much historically and therefore wouldn't be as responsible. And that the CBDRRC, that's the idea that whoever made the mess it historically needs to be the most responsible for cleaning it up, as opposed to whoever's emitting the most right now needs to reduce the most, which would put China on the hook, as you're saying. Is that an accurate summary?
Absolutely. That's a really succinct summary of what I just rambled.
No, the details are great that you presented. That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. And there is also a more strategic reason for why China wants to align itself with developing countries. So UNCCC operates on that consensus decision-making model, right? If a country would object to a certain paragraph of the legal text, for example, that paragraph of text would be vetoed, essentially. And China doesn't really want to be that veto player that's seen as ugly or destructive or obstructive to this process. So if it's able to have the backings of other developing countries, it could easily frame its objection as for the developing country because it is bad for the developing country.
Because it's unfair.
It's unfair to ask developing countries to report more or to be more transparent about their decision-making process, things like that.
Other than being a leader for countries in the global south and championing the CBDRC principle, what are some other ways that China is shifting global China governance, especially within the last 10 years?
Discursive power and positioning itself with developing countries is just one avenue out of the many China is doing to influence global climate governance. Our article also looked at itself's cooperation program on knowledge sharing of its own climate solutions with developing countries and how China is also advancing a technocentric image of climate action and largely through the Belt and Road Initiative. On the knowledge sharing piece, the main player here is the China South-South Climate Cooperation Program, or the SSCCP. It serves the purpose of building trust in the Global South by exporting Chinese experience on climate action. Between 2015 and 2020, we found that it has allocated over 1 billion Chinese yuan to programs in 35 developing countries in Asia and Africa. This number is on track to grow as China invests more into its international development assistance and investment programs, particularly in Belt and Road countries. And what we found is China is exporting its knowledge and experience over large-scale ecosystem management and restoration campaigns to developing countries. Since 1978, China has been planting trees in its northern arid ecosystems to conserve water, to prevent desertification, and to minimize the impact of sandstorms on major cities like Beijing. It's largely been successful in terms of ecosystem restoration, poverty reduction, and disaster risk reduction. It has also created a massive carbon sink in the northern China region that sucks carbon dioxide out of the air. So that's been great. It's sharing this experience with countries that are interested in what we call ecosystem-based adaptation or nature-based solutions, the idea that using nature to solve societal issues and climate change. China was one of the co-leads of the UN Climate Action Summit's nature-based solution track. It's providing technical support to initiatives like the Great Green Wall of the Sahara and Sahel in Northern Africa that draws on lessons learned from soil and watershed management programs in China and China's own Green Wall project in the Taklamakan Desert in Northern China. It's also supporting ecosystem-based adaptation projects in Mauritania, the Seychelles, Nepal, and other developing countries across Asia and the Pacific region. So the idea of knowledge sharing and knowledge exporting is a big part of enhancing China's image as a leader in nature-based solutions and a trusted partner for the Global South in sharing its valuable insights and experience and also its money to fund these projects.
Just a quick note, and maybe you don't have details on these projects, but as somebody who's on the outside of these type of projects, we're talking about a shift in global climate governance. Is there something different inherently within how China kind of runs and operates this type of carbon offset program as compared to traditional donors? Or are they run somewhat similarly and China is just more active in it?
Mm-hmm. I think nature-based solution has been around in the climate space for a long time, but it hasn't been mainstreamed until really in 2019 when China and New Zealand started the nature-based solution track at the UN Climate Action Summit. So these projects are certainly just large-scale, industrial-scale afforestation projects that are planting massive amount of trees, that are restoring ecosystems like mangroves, and also doing a lot of other enhancing ecosystem services. These are a type of climate solutions that didn't really catch the mainstream policymakers' attention until very recently. Traditional donors, I think when talking about mitigation or adaptation, we think about hard adaptation options. So these are things like building a dam or building better infrastructure that can withstand climate impacts. Whereas nature-based solution or ecosystem-based adaptation would use a more green approach. We use the natural power. We use ecosystem services to achieve these goals. So this is a big difference from gray infrastructure. These are dams, hydro dams, and things like that. And also we're seeing a lot of mitigation projects that focus on renewable energy or hard energy transition instead of just carbon sequestration through natural means. And I think the shift in global climate governance here is China is mainstreaming this approach in developing countries to say that we could achieve great economic development while also caring for our environment. Also, we are putting a focus on climate adaptation instead of purely mitigation, which is what Western donors really want developing countries to do, is to reduce their emissions. But oftentimes, adapting to the climate impacts are ignored by a lot of global North donors until very recently, of course.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about how the article frames it is it's not necessarily only that nature-based solutions are novel, but that this is one kind of channel through which China is exporting, quote unquote, its model. It's exporting its own experience as a model, which is actually, I would say, not new at all. I think that the whole development model since the 40s, since post-World War II, has been like, rich countries know how to get rich. Let's teach others by basically exporting our technology, which usually means exporting the image of ourselves as brilliant and as generously handing our technology out, which also we produce and make money off of. So it's not totally new in that sense, but the idea that nature-based solutions is something that has become part of China's aid apparatus and China's expanding its own leadership and environment globally, I thought was an interesting way of emphasizing that shift. Does my pitch of development aid sound conspiratorial?
No, I think it's totally on track. China has been trying to say that the Western development model doesn't work for developing countries. They've been pointing out failures in how development aid has been distributed across Africa, across developing countries. And now China is saying that we have the success story.
Right.
Of a developing country, impoverished developing country that's grown to one of the massive economy in the world. And here is how we did it. And these are our experiences. These are developing country experiences that other developing countries could follow. So there is more of a reflection of what China has been doing in its own domestic development pathway and its approach to climate action, its approach to environmental conservation, etc.
I think that's a great way of leading into my next question. You said that earlier was the North-South divide is the kind of million-dollar question. But I think the million-dollar question for a lot of people is actually, then is China just being primarily self-interested in its motivations? And I love that question because when people ask it about China, I oftentimes think that they're suggesting that no one else is self-interest motivated. But of course, every country, I think, is, even in climate negotiations. So as China takes on this leadership role, what are its interests in doing so? Is it just politicking, putting on the global South hat when it benefits itself, and then putting on the we're a leader in global climate adaptation technology when it's trying to sell it or give its technology to other developing countries? Is there a different way you would frame this beyond the idea of just self-interest?
For sure. I share your view that these kind of framing doesn't really get us very far. I think every actor in the international stage have some motivation to pursue things in the diplomatic world. And Peter and I, we mentioned in our article that there are research out there that argues that China is in fact not seeking to be a leader in global climate governance. Trombetta argued that China doesn't want any new legally binding responsibilities imposed on itself. And being a leader in the global climate governance, there certainly will be new obligations and new responsibilities. Its involvement goes insofar as to its own security and economic development interests are not affected by the global climate regime. China is trying to build this image of a responsible great power. And on building its soft power through either supporting developing countries or being the vanguard for developing countries in the climate negotiation space, or through its knowledge sharing, through South-South cooperation activities, it's in China's interest to be present, to be active, and to be seen in the climate space. This could allow China to be that responsible great power, or to be perceived as a responsible great power. It is sharing its knowledge. It is doing something on the climate crisis. It is increasing its climate ambition domestically. It wants to show the world that it is no longer a spoiler in the climate world, and that, you know, its domestic policies on climate change have greatly improved, and comparatively, its climate ambition has increased a lot. So looking at recent coverage on China, climate change might be the only positive piece about China's diplomacy or China's policies in recent years. So this soft power in turns a lot.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And this soft power, right, it allows China to secure its own interest in negotiations. When it unites the developing countries group with an alliance, it could counter what it perceived to be a Western-dominated discourse of common action and shape the global institution to its own vision, adhering to the principle of common but differentiated responsibility. It's a state-driven process that each country should follow their own development trajectory to decide on common action. And that, of course, developed countries should do more in terms of climate financing and provision of support and technologies to developing countries. I read in her recently published book, China's Environmental Foreign Relations, she argued that China is a constructive actor It's about building a discourse and an image of responsible great power that drives China's engagement on environmental foreign policy. And this is partially in line with what the CCP is putting forward domestically, especially with the rise of ecological civilization, that ideology by President Xi Jinping since 2018. And in this process, if China's proactive engagement with the Global South would be able to bring extra benefits to Chinese companies, like for infrastructure construction, telecommunication, or renewable energy through the Belt and Road Initiative, then all the better. So yeah, of course, China is doing these out of its own interest, but it doesn't really take away the fact that it is trying to do productive things in the space. It is providing technology. It is providing knowledge to places that desperately need them. It's championing adaptation, which is a critical thing for many developing countries in the UNCCC regime. And in this process, if China could take a couple of stabs at the Western countries for their inaction, then it certainly fits China's modus operandi in its own diplomacy in recent years.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Do you see China's growing leadership in climate negotiations feeding or being bolstered by China's growing soft power and global influence in general in other spheres? Put it another way, is there something special about climate negotiations and China's global growth and global governance and soft power? Or is this just one facet of China's getting bigger and so it's having more influence? Or is there something very specific or elevated on the soft power realm in Chinese foreign policy?
I think that's a great question. As a researcher in global environmental politics, I can't really speak to any other areas except for climate change. But certainly, I think having to do something about climate change is a consensus by China and the majority of the Western countries that it might see as adversary. The growing Chinese engagement in this space is, I think, a manifestation of a shift in its domestic policy. From Carbon Brief, he published an article listing 9 key moments that changed China's mind about climate change. And President Xi Jinping played a major role in this transformation domestically. In 2018, ecological civilization was put forward as a guiding ideology for the Communist Party. And it's certainly with the rise of ecological civilization and the idea of the two mountain theory by Xi Jinping, it is doing more on the domestic front to combat pollutions, to doing more on climate action and solving environmental issues. And now, as they're improving their domestic policies, it is looking outward to see how it could improve its image as a big polluter and to be a more constructive and more engaged actor in the climate space. So it's not necessarily they want to be a leader, but to be seen as a player that is not destructive to the multilateral process. And it is, of course, a manifestation of its growing diplomatic and soft power in the international space. It knows how to protect its own interests. It knows how to forge an alliance with developing countries and to use that to counter the Western-dominated institution, and certainly to benefit from carbon emission trading or the booming renewable energy industry. I think BRI is a great manifestation of that. China is pouring more and more money into green BRI investments. BRI investments in low carbon energy projects have grown to around $2 billion since 2015. And in 2020, the amount of green energy financing surpassed BRI's investments in fossil fuel projects. And that is before when China announced that it will cease investment in fossil fuel projects overseas. So certainly BRI is a big part of this holistic strategy China is putting on to do more on climate action, to benefit its domestic industries, and to be seen as this constructive, responsible great power. I think in recent years, and we didn't really include this fact in our article, but that there is something different about climate change. So climate change negotiation might be special. Despite everything that was going on between US and China during the first few months of the Biden presidency, the trade war, the Huawei issue, and the South China Sea issue, John Kerry, which is Biden administration's climate envoy, still went to Shanghai to meet with Xie Zhenhua, China's chief climate negotiator, and also the China's climate envoy. And the Alaska talks in May of 2021 was very frosty between the two countries, if we remember that period of time. But the two countries' climate envoys still met regularly virtually to discuss bilateral cooperation on climate change. Again, it's something that both countries want to see more being done on climate change, even if they disagree on literally everything else. So it could partly be a moral leadership or a strategic issue that China wants to keep engaging with the West during a very turbulent period of time diplomatically. But it's certainly shows that China's growing soft power and the manifestation of its shifting away from that hide your talent and bide your time doctrine.
Yeah, I think, Eric, you're onto something in that There was so much emphasis on when Biden came into office too about we're going to be really hard on China, but we're going to be really cooperative on climate change with China. And it does seem like a special realm in which that is believed at least to be possible. Do you know what's happening with the Convention on Biological Diversity in Kunming? Have you heard whether things are going to move forward and any activity is actually going to happen in Kunming? And China seems closed still and they've put it off a couple times.
Yeah, which is also another issue, right? This thing was supposed to be done in 2020, and now we're 2022, almost 2023, it's still there. It's lingering around. They had the talk in Geneva, which countries still couldn't agree on a lot of issues. The list goes on and on, but like genetic material sharing, benefit sharing, also financing is a big portion. And how do you connect biodiversity to climate change in a meaningful way? Should we slap a mitigation target on the biodiversity framework that's linked to climate change? And lots of countries would say, no, that's the Climate Change Commission's job. That's not the Biological Diversity Commission's job. So there are a lot of like divergence of views in these areas. So they agreed to add the Nairobi talk in June.
Okay.
So trying to smooth things out. Hopefully they can reach decision by COP. Right now they're saying COP might be in August to early September. Still happening in Kunming, but we really don't know.
Yeah, it just seems totally unpredictable. That's really fascinating because it's so hard to figure out what's going on from far away. But also, I'm sure not many people know what's going on, even if you're in Kunming. Interesting to get your take. What is the future of global climate governance and what specifically is China's role in your opinion?
I think we had a couple $1 billion question today, and this is certainly going to be on the list. We reached a couple speculative points in our article. We don't know for sure that this will be the trend of global climate governance, and this is exactly what China will do in it. But from looking at what China has done, building its discursive power in the negotiation space, knowledge sharing with developing countries, and also massive investments in renewable energy and green infrastructure in developing countries through the Belt and Road Initiative, I think we can bring out some conclusions on how global climate governance will go in the future. First, we might see the North-South dichotomy manifest even further in the UN Framework Convention climate change space. With China and other powerful developing countries, India, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, Iran, them help fortifying this North-South divide, certain negotiations might be hard to reach consensus. So now the Paris Agreement's implementation guideline have been completed. Future battles could probably focus on climate financing, equity in climate action, addressing loss and damage, and more focus and prioritization on adaptation. These are all developing countries' priorities. This brings back to the point that some observer might say China is being destructive, it's being obstructive of the whole process, it is undermining the whole Paris Agreement. But if we look at it from a different angle, these are things that developing countries care about. They care about financing. Without meaningful investment, they can't really do a lot of stuff on climate change. And they care about loss and damage. These are things that already happened. The hurricane, the flooding, these are hazardous events that have already happened, have already caused damage. So how do we make sure that we can ensure these things? And how can we make sure that there are enough money to build back better? So these are things that developing countries really care about within the climate space. It's a good thing that China and other powerful developing countries are bringing focus and bringing attention to these issues. But on the other hand, it might cause some delay in negotiation. It might have some roadblocks in achieving consensus. There are a lot of different opinions on that. We also speculated that China's knowledge sharing campaigns, more focus will be put on nature-based solutions, ecosystem-based adaptation, etc. They will increasingly reflect, as we discussed before, that China's domestic practices and its own development model. These include a strong role of the state, a pragmatic, flexible, learning by doing approach to policy planning and policy implementation, with a strong emphasis on political stability, organizational efficiency, massive scale, and also limited civil society participation, much environmental projects implemented domestically in China. And lastly, global climate governance could certainly increasingly defined by a technocentric, top-down, supply-side climate solution. Things like energy transition, green infrastructure, renewable energy, and these are exacerbated by the BRI investments in developing countries. These could certainly reduce emissions and support development efforts in developing countries, but they don't necessarily address the question of unsustainable economic growth, relentless consumption and production, and also just inefficient governance models. But whether or not these China's influences on global climate governance, whether or not they are positive or negative, I will leave to the listeners to decide, because there are a lot of different angles to see these questions, and there are a lot of different views on whether or not it's being productive in the short term or destructive in the long term.
I'm highly underqualified qualified to address that, but that's a great points. Thank you.
I'll leave that to the listener as well. Jeffrey, this has been such an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for coming on. Can you stick around for recommendations?
Yeah, for sure.
Wonderful. You've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast. Remember, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, analysis on the Belt and Road Initiative, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Belt and Road Pod. Also, you can, if you like this episode, you can subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, thank you to Tylee Nee for editing this episode. Jeffrey, what would you like to recommend to our listeners? Something you've been, or a few things that you've been either reading, watching, doing, can be China related or not.
Yeah, for sure. I think towards the end of my master's degree, all the books in my shelf is about China environments. And so that's just what I've been reading. As I mentioned during the podcast, I mentioned Heidi Wang Keding's new book. I guess it's no longer new. It came out last year. It's China's Environmental Foreign Relations, published by Routerich. It's really great. Very unique inside look into China's decision-making process on its foreign policy in terms of environment. It talks about the Commission on Biological Diversity. It talks about UNFCCC. It talks about ecological civilization and that whole transformation and all the implications that came about. So that book was very helpful during Peter and my research into China's influence on global economic governance. So highly recommend that book.
I just looked it up. It looks great.
Yeah, it's also a pretty short, sweet book. Like, it's not 500 pages long, so that's always a plus. I guess the other main thing is as I mentioned, there's analysis on the 9 key moments that changed China's mind about climate change. That was published by Carbon Brief. So if you just search on Google, Carbon Brief, China, and it should be the first article that pops up. It's by a veteran journalist, Liu Jianqiang. And it's a great article that lists out all the key moments about Xi Jinping, that's about the Communist Party, and how China is transforming its policy in terms of environment and climate change. It's a great read. And I think we also mentioned nature-based solutions. My good friend, Marina Melendez, just published a new paper on environmental science and policy. It's called Competing Narratives of Nature-Based Solutions, Leveraging the Power of Nature or Dangerous Distraction. I think it's a really great discussion over this quote-unquote novel concept and to see how different actors frame it and use it to their own advantage and whether or not that's a good or bad thing for global climate action or for biological diversity. So highly recommend it.
Awesome. She's a youth climate leader.
She definitely is. Yes, yeah. She's awesome.
Great. Awesome. Eric, what do you want to recommend?
My one recommendation is probably a little bit tough for one to do. 2 weeks ago, I was lucky enough to be able to go to Kenya for a work trip. I'd never been one who was really interested on going on a safari. I don't know why. It's many people's bucket list item. I was like, that would be fun to go on one, but I would never spend all the money and do all that. But since I was there, I went on one, and it was absolutely magical. If you don't have it on your bucket list item, put it on your bucket list and try at some point in time to go on a safari. It's magical.
You can do that in Ithaca, I think. I'll figure out what the Ithaca safari is, the equivalent.
Yes.
We'll find it.
Well, it's probably really great birds. I love birds. And within that, I was actually able to go on with the safari. I took the SGR, the China Finance and Backed Railroad in Kenya. I do plan on actually writing something about my experience on it. It was a really smooth and wonderful train ride. And Juliet, how about yourself?
Okay, I have a recommendation. It is a book called Traveling with Big Brother by Solomon Elusoji. Solomon is a journalist and writer and a jack of all trades, it seems, from Nigeria. He did a master's in journalism, I believe. He did some time in China studying journalism, which he does. He was a journalist before then and still is. And he writes this amazing book about his experience in China. My favorite title of a chapter is, Why Are You Staring at Me? Which is something I wondered so many times when I was in China. Why are you staring at me? But as a Black man, he gets stared at way more, I think, than I probably did as a half Chinese American woman. And it's just full of a vision of China that I really miss, having not been able to travel there for the last few years, but a vision of his experience in China that's also just so different for me. So really wonderful resonances as someone who was a Lao Wai in China, but really good learning. I learned a lot from his perspective as well. And he just seems like a really awesome person overall, doing a ton of interesting journalism. We'll put some links to his work in the show notes, but I highly recommend the book.
Yeah, we got to get him on the show. And also, not only was he in China, he was in China on a scholarship to learn about journalism from a Chinese institution. What was it? Fudan University? I can't remember. But anyway, so it was even his experience, not only just going to China and learning, but with other journalists from many of the global south and like their experience and learning not only about China, but about journalism in China.
I just looked it up. He's doing a master's of global journalism at Renmin University, which is like one of China's top universities for journalism. Really cool. All right.
Well, Jeffrey, again, thank you so much for joining us on the Belt and Road podcast.
It's been lovely talking to you too. Thanks so much for inviting me.